Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Mr. John Cecconi, a former state senator from Rhode Island who currently serves as a vice president at the Substance Use and Mental Health Leadership Council. He's also a member of the Rhode Island Governor's Task Force on Overdose Prevention and Intervention. He's the host of the show Recovery TV Rhode Island, which can be seen on MyRITV. And with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. Cecconi. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
You have multiple lifetimes worth of experiences, truly, and you've seen addiction policy from multiple vantage points. Tell us the perspectives, really at a high level, of Mr. Cecconi, the politician, the advocate, the media personality. What do each of these perspectives reveal about addiction in this country?
Well, let me first start with how I got really involved in addiction and substance use and mental health. So a long time ago, when I was at the age of 18, I had a family member who was addicted to alcohol. And he was my father's partner in a business. And ultimately, the day I got engaged, I went home with the diamond and showed my father. He told me that the business had just been taken over by the bank. And I was out of a job at 19 years old. Following that, at 19 years old, I didn't go to college because I was promised a business. You know, I learned from the bottom up. And it would that someday would be my business. So when that rug is pulled away from you at 19 and you didn't want to follow the education path, you wanted to follow the business path. Now, all of a sudden, all four walls started coming crashing down on you and you had nowhere to go. At 19 years old, I was in the backyard crying like a baby. I had nowhere to go. I'm getting engaged. I didn't want the former in-laws to think I was a loser. You had to pick up by the bootstraps and continue. So I ended up getting a job, and it's kind of like a funny story now, but it wasn't funny then.
Yeah.
I got a job with Amico Insurance pumping gas for all the insurance cars that Amica had on the road. And within 2 weeks, the boss in the print shop saw how conscientious I was in pumping gas, cleaning the windows, and I was a hard worker. And at that time, I had three jobs. I was pumping gas. I was a Rhode Island hockey official, and I was also a Zamboni driver. So I was a rink rat too. After that, they taught me how to run a press. I'm a printer. Then I went to work at Federated Lithographers, where I was a printer. We used to print the Topps baseball cards. And then after that, I got elected president of the union. And that's when my career really took off. And I joke a lot with a lot of people saying, high school is the longest 6 years of my life. Because I never went to college, but I learned a lot on the street.
Yeah.
As being a president of the union, $1.5 million budget, I'm responsible for a lot of men and women. And at that point, Quebecor, a Canadian-based company, came in and they bought Federated. And within 2 years, they put it out of business. So again, I was no job again. So I ended up going to work to being a senior business agent for the state of Rhode Island, for the local unions. And then in 2000, I got elected. I beat a 22-year incumbent. By 150 votes. It's when the Gore-Bush recount happened. My recount happened the same time, but I ultimately was the winner.
And this is for the state Senate.
Yeah, state Senate in Rhode Island. And then they tell you when you get into politics in Rhode Island to just focus on a few things. So one of the things that I wanted to focus on was substance use and mental health because of what happened prior to, me starting a career. So I ended up doing that. And then in 2009, I was asked to run for lieutenant governor. So I quit my job with the union. I started my own company because I didn't want to be tied to any particular organization. And then a couple of days before the filing, the current lieutenant governor, who I was going to take her place, was going to run for governor, said she wasn't going to do it. So then again, no job. So I picked up by the bootstraps, and then I started a labor paper in Rhode Island. I also bought another paper in Rhode Island. I had two radio shows at the time. And then I left the Rhode Island Senate in 2012. And this organization's Rhode Island Substance Use Mental Health Leadership Council asked me to go to work for them on a part-time basis, which I did. And then I have to do a year waiting in the revolving door. So then I went back into the state house doing lobbying for substance use and mental health. So as today, I am the vice president of operations here, which is a full-time job. I have the TV show, which I just started in September, that's doing very well. I'm getting invitations from all over the country, including yours, to be on today, to talk about substance use and mental health.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that we have to press on with podcasts, TV interviews and stuff like that, because no one gets it. And I say that tongue in cheek, because I testified last night in front of the Senate House Finance for the ARPA money here in Rhode Island, that we were supposed to get $255 million and the governor cut it to 42. Wow. And they level funded Medicaid. So it's the poor people on the street that need services that are not getting services, that are not getting attention. And I tell my boss all the time, she's a doctor in education, very smart lady. I said, you'll be the good guy, I'll be the bad guy. Because I don't, what you tell me, I take at face value, because I grew up on the street and I'm very street smart. So I say to people all the time, I'm not going to tell you something you just want to hear. I'm going to tell you what's really going on. And some people like it and some people don't like it. But after that testimony last night, and I was getting texts from all facets of people that watched it on TV about how passionate I was, I say to them, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of about 20,000 people that are having problems with substance use and mental health here in Rhode Island. They don't have the opportunity like I have to be in front of a House Finance Committee or a Senate Finance Committee or Health and Human Services to say really what, not that they don't want to hear, but I'm going to tell them the truth on what's really happening on the street. Our system in Rhode Island is broken, and broken badly, to the point of 24 to 28 hour wait in the emergency rooms.
Yeah.
No psychiatric care for children. No residential treatment for adolescent care in Rhode Island. All our kids have to go out of state. And DCYF last night testified that they're spending $14 million out of state. And I got up and said, listen, $14 million out of state. It's the low-income kids that are having these problems, that the families don't have the capabilities to go to family intervention because they don't have the means to go to New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, and Connecticut, where the children are, because we have no services here. We're putting all our kids out of state. It doesn't make any sense. The system is badly broken. And my boss tells me all the time, this is trying to build a house on a swamp.
Yeah. I love the passion by which you are articulating these major policy issues. The intersection of healthcare and law at the individual level, affecting the most vulnerable, the low socioeconomic patients, seems to be lost in the halls of governance. City Hall does not understand the plight of the individual patient. You have been on the ins and on the outs. You've seen all sides. What are we missing? Why is this disconnect repeatedly appearing?
You know what the disconnect is, and I'll tell you. And it's sad, because it's right in front of your face. If it doesn't affect the people in the building that write these laws, they don't care about it. Even if they hear it from one constituent, two constituents, they don't care about it. But you know when they care? When they pick up the phone and say, John, can you help me get my son into treatment?
Yeah.
He's really bad. And I get this son into treatment. And I said this a few times. I'm not afraid to tell everybody in here. And I don't use people's names when they call me. And I said, I will be the first person that you call. If your son, your daughter, your mother, your father, your aunt, your uncle needs treatment, you want to connect with me because I have the means to connect them to residential treatment or outpatient services. But when I need help, you guys are all like ostriches. You bury your head in the sand. This is the year 2022 of substance use and mental health policy, funding for all this OPA money. It needs to be brought to the forefront ASAP. We can't wait any longer. I'm just speaking in Rhode Island, but I know it's across the country because I sit on the national telephone calls once a month of what's happening nationally. It's happening in every state. People don't get it. They only get it when their family member or close relative is in trouble.
There's this belief that addiction, or at least some level of dependency, is a moral failing. I guess you can go through the annals of American history as to why we think in this manner, whether it's the Puritan ethos of hard work or whether it's something more modern. But there's this belief that it's an individual moral failing and that people who have this somehow need to be separated, if you will, from others in society. I can't help but feel that that has some impact in why effective legislation doesn't actually transpire and really seems more like a dog and pony show, if you will, where they say we committed X amount for this issue or that issue, but it doesn't translate because I think, as you alluded to, the perception is wrong to begin with.
Stigma. That's the key word, stigma. Yeah. Because when I was growing up, I can remember vividly, you know, you'd be driving down the street and there was a homeless person on the corner and you hear your parents say, oh, look at that bum. You know, here's a bum. But let me tell you something. And I used to do a lot of homeless work in the General Assembly. You don't wake up on a Monday morning and say to yourself, you know what? Today's the day I want to be homeless. I want to be homeless. I want to be a bum. That doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. And the stigma along with mental health and substance use is a stigma that we're trying to break down all sorts of barriers to this. And it's starting to work. It's starting to work. And research shows, a lot of research shows, it's a gene within the family that these individuals get that make them turn to substances and mental health issues. You know, in Rhode Island right now, I can tell you that because of the pandemic, alcohol sales are up 234%.
Yeah.
234%. Now, great if you're a liquor store owner. Not good if you're a provider or if you're someone who's been stuck in the house for the past 2 years and you're drinking like crazy. Ultimately, you're going to be a $1 million baby. Because your body's going to break down. You're going to need to, whether it's liver transplant, kidney failure, or whatever, the skyrocketing medical costs on being someone who is addicted to alcohol is tremendous, just like it is if you're on opioids or anything else. This is what I don't think the legislature understands or the healthcare providers. Now, in Rhode Island right now, you're only given 14 days of detox. Now, just think of it. Think of this now. All right, John, we're going to put you at ad care for 14 days to detox, and then we're going to let you go to outpatient. Guess what? It don't work.
No.
You're going to go to relapse. You're going to go back in for another 14 days. Then you're going to go back in for another 14 days. Then you're going to go back in for another 14 days. By the time you're done, if in fact you do complete it, it's 5 or 6 trips. Now, if that person was given 28, 30 days to get clean, to get their head on straight, to receive counseling, to receive medicated assisted treatment, then it wouldn't cost as much. And this is very difficult to get through the minds of the insurance companies.
I want to hone in on this issue because you've spoken about this at length in other places. You cite a few concerns. One is the low reimbursement for addiction type services. Mm-hmm. Two, which you just alluded to, this 14-day threshold, as opposed to customizing the duration as per the patient needs. And you've alluded to certain financial implications that overwhelm the clinical need for these patients. That to me seems like the perfect mix of bad policy, where the individual needs are supplanted by guidelines and rules that are regimented to put that individual, the very individual intended to protect, in a disadvantageous position. Mm-hmm. How do you look at this now in terms of a solution? We know the problem, you contextualize it from the level of the individual to the level of policy. How do we now move forward to a solution with that?
All right, so let me start with the rates. The rates in Rhode Island haven't been increased in 14 years. And I utilized this example last night in front of the House Finance. 14 years ago, could you as a business owner continue to do business with the rate of pay that you were getting paid 14 years ago? You can't. It's impossible. So how do you expect us to do that? We as providers still have to provide the care to whoever walks through that door, whether they have insurance or no insurance. The hospitals get uncompensated care, a big chunk of money at the end of every budget year in the General Assembly. We get $0, but we continue to do it. Example, Newport Mental Health last night testified $1.5 million in uncompensated care, and they're a nonprofit. How do you sustain that?
No.
You can't sustain that. That's number one. The rates need to be adjusted and adjusted fairly. We're not asking for more than what we deserve. Fair compensation, just like every other business in the state. And what the governor does here, he hops on this small business. We are small business and we are getting raped. And I'll use that word raped by the hospitals because they're paying huge bonuses for employees to go to hospital-based care. We have a nursing shortage in substance use and mental health right now because the hospitals are paying 25,000 sign-on bonuses. We can't compete. We have outpatient services that give methadone on the weekend, can't give methadone on the weekend because we don't have enough nurses. So what happens if John Tassoni needs to get his methadone on Saturday and can't get it again until Monday until they have a regular shift of nurses? You know what's going to happen? They're going to go on the street and they're going to get bad dope like we had it yesterday in Rhode Island. We had an alert yesterday that was... I don't know how many in South County died of a bad batch of fentanyl.
Jeez.
The system is broken and it's broken badly and no one seems to want to get it. You know, and sometimes, you know, my father used to say to me, you want to slap somebody in the back of the head and say, hey, pay attention to what you're doing. Pay attention.
Yeah.
So the rates are number one. Policy is number two. We need to get the General Assembly and the governor on board with policy. Because the policy portion of it, all three segments that we had talked about before you asked me this question are all intertwined with one another. Because if you can't fix one without the other two, and you can't fix the other two without the number one, it's got to be a collaborative effort. And we, Dr. Storti and I, sat with the General Assembly and said, we want to be your partner to fix the system. We used to be number one in the country with substance use and mental health. Now we're like 48.
Wow.
So what happened? I'll tell you what happened. The money that was supposed to be spent on substance use and mental health was taken out of the budget because we were number one. They didn't think we deserved it anymore. So now what? We're number 48. Now we have sixth graders. We get calls here all the time. We have sixth graders with alcohol poisoning. Sixth graders, think of that. That's 10, 11 years old. Alcohol poisoning. We get the kids telling us that they're doing dope with their mothers and fathers. They're drinking beers and wine with their mothers and fathers. the country is going in the wrong direction as far as substance use and mental health. And we need to fix it fast, because if not, I have a grandson who's 7. And I said to my daughter, I tell her all the time, I hope to God I'm here long enough to get him through college. And I always tell my grandson who's 7, you got to be a leader and not a follower.
Yeah. Inherent in all of this is just how we look at addiction. Mm-hmm. You mentioned there's a genetic basis for it. You can mm-hmm. also argue that there's a societal basis for it as well. Mm-hmm. Is part of this a delusion among those in positions of power, failing to recognize the realities that people go through, and that addiction is inherent in their lives, almost as if a person in a position of power is inherently blessed with certain financial opportunities that others are not? Is addiction an inherent part of life for majority of Americans, where we can't look at it like a failing, but we have to look at it as something that they have to accept and acknowledge in part of their lives?
Well, I think addiction now, along with the pandemic, is a perfect storm.
Yeah.
People who have been isolated turn to either alcohol or opioids or fentanyl to get themselves away from being trapped within the four walls. We've in Rhode Island have broken another record on overdoses, 414 last year, not counting October, November, and December, because we have so much of a backlog in the ME's office on the deaths. You know, and I say this all the time, there's only 3 people that made money during this pandemic. The dealer, the funeral homes, and the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
And that's a sad combination. Now, I do believe the majority of political individuals get it. I do believe that they're a little bit more skittish on the budget end. But the problem is that being in the General Assembly, you know the quirks that that the General Assembly has, because there's no long-term plans on budgeting. Their budget is from July 1 to June 30th every year. That's all their vision is. It's just that one budget. Mm. You know, there's no long-term goals in budgeting. And when you look at that and you look at treatment, whether it be for substance use or mental health, you look at ED visits for substance use or mental health. I mean, where did you ever think that you would have to wait in an emergency for 24 to 28 hours? And I didn't make that up. The Department of Health reported that 2 meetings ago.
Jeez.
That was the wait in the emergency rooms. Now, if you're brought in by an ambulance, obviously it's a little bit different than if you walk in and you tell them you got mental health or substance use issues. So we have a push right now in Rhode Island to have a lot of the fire stations become safe stations, where people can go in, say, listen, I need help. I need treatment. Here's all the stuff I've been taking. Can you get me some help? And that's starting to percolate. It's starting to move down the field, and more people are starting to utilize that in the cities more than the suburban areas. So, I mean, I just did it from the town I live in Smithfield. I said to my town manager, we were getting 3 to 5 calls a week on overdoses. I said, we got to do something. We can't just sit here and sit still. We got to open up these safe stations. It's going to cost you a couple of $1,000 to get it up and running. Let's do it. A couple of $1,000. Listen, I'll give you the $2,000 to start it. Start it. You're saving lives. How much is a life worth? All you have to do is save one person. Is it worth that $2,000 you expended?
Yeah.
You know, and everything's about money, but there's nothing that looks at the whole 5,000 foot level. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They're just focused on one thing, just that one budget from July 1 to June 30th. And we shouldn't be doing that in 2022. We should have long-term goals, how we're going to spend it, how we're going to give people raises and the rates that we're paying 14 years ago, and you expect me to run my business? I can't keep help. Yeah. You can go to McDonald's and make more than a clinician can, and you need a license to be a clinician.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. You've been quoted as saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, too many people seem to be working in silos, protecting turf, rather than working together as collaborators.
Correct.
You give the example of the annual fiscal budget as an example where people are not working together, and then you give the example of the firehouse as a safe space as an example of collaborations. Can you talk a little bit about what it takes to enhance these collaborations? Is it a different way to look at these annual budgets, or is it outreach at a direct level?
Well, I first of all, I think it's a leadership problem. You know, you have certain departments that are responsible for A, B, and C, and you have other departments that are D, E, and F, and then you have other departments. And what I've seen over the years is that departments, they don't talk to one another. I'll use BHDDH as an example, Department of Behavioral Health. Have 11 directors in 15 years.
Wow.
How is that sustainable? Number one, how is that continuity wise? Number one, because whoever comes in, they have a different view of things. And you look at it's like a mountain. You go down and you're up. You go down and you're up. You go down, you're up. And there's no sustainability of staffing. There's no sustainability of direction. And there's no long-term goals. How do we do this? So you have BHDDH, 11 directors. You have OHHS, different directors. We've had three directors since I've been in this seat for 5 years now in the Medicaid department. Three different directors. It's unsustainable. The leadership, and we just had a transition of governors because Governor Raimondo went to Washington and the lieutenant governor stepped in. And I can tell you, as I sit here today, we have 12 acting directors.
Jeez.
We have more acting directors in Rhode Island than we do in Hollywood right now. And I say that publicly all the time. How can departments run efficiently if you got acting directors, because they're all afraid to make a decision because they may or may not be in line for the director's spot? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, that's like me coming on this podcast and say, oh my God, if I say the wrong thing, I'm going to get in trouble. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care. I want people to know I don't care. I'm here as an advocate to help these poor people that are sleeping on the street, who are not getting the medication that they need, that are not getting doctor visits that they deserve, that have mental health issues, substance use issues. Folks, smarten up. These 20,000 people that we service every year in the 33 agencies that I represent, it's billions of dollars. Billions,
yeah.
Not millions, billions. Step back. Let's redo the system and let's do it right. Okay. Never mind who's going to worry about what turf is what turf. It's not about you. It's about the patients. It's about the people that need the services.
On that note, let's transition and talk about the laws and the policies themselves. Mm-hmm. So let's say in the rare instance when a law or a budgetary approval does pass, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of fanfare around it. There's obviously the ribbon cutting ceremonies and people are quick to seek glory. But then the laws themselves or the policies themselves seem to only provide one restriction, one access. What is it about these laws and these policies from the inside in, from your perspective as a former state senator and as an advocate looking from the inside? Why do we keep these simple laws and policies that only seem to focus on one or two things as opposed to just broad policies that may affect the patient as a whole. The moment a patient is in relapse, the moment the patient seeks therapy, long-term care, why do we have these simplistic laws and policies?
Well, I think, first of all, the simplistic stuff, I believe right now are going away.
Okay.
We have some good fighters here in Rhode Island for substance use and mental health on the Senate side. On the House side, we have to do a little bit more education to people, but they're starting to get it now. They're starting to get it. Now, I saw a lot of heads nodding last night because now they're starting to get the calls because their folks can't get the services that they need through the pandemic and other avenues. The chair of housing, the chair of Health and Human Services on the Senate side is a good friend of mine. And I have conversations with him every week to tell him what's really happening, boots on the ground. And that's what they'd really need to hear. Because let me tell you something. When you're an elected official, you have over 2,000 bills in Rhode Island that you have to talk about and be educated on. And that's when I said earlier, you have to focus on two or three different things. And everybody focuses on two or three different things. There's no real experts. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's a part-time legislature here in Rhode Island. So it's very, very difficult. So we need us as advocates need to educate them about good policy, bad policy, the whole person, not just opioids. It's the whole person we have to treat. Because if you don't treat the whole person, something's going to go haywire.
Let me ask you this. I think it's important. Before I jump in, I want to just ask one quick clarification question. Can I use the word lobbyist? Are you okay with that word? Okay.
Yeah, I'm a lobbyist.
I just wanted to get that out there, and I wanted to make sure I spoke in respect. You talk about educating the representatives, the senators. That is, in a way, lobbying.
Right.
Talk about that process of lobbying at the state capital. You have these experiences, you have the medical knowledge, you have the policies now put in front of the capital on the voting block. People are making decisions, yes or no. They need to be educated on these policies. That process of education is a process of lobbying. Talk through that process and what you do to effectuate medically centric, patient sensible education.
Okay, so I'll give you our conversations that we had last night in front of the Finance Committee. Now, there's a lot of money and OPA money, $1.2 billion here in Rhode Island. Rhode Island Foundation had a group of very smart individuals from Brown all over the place to talk about how much money should be put into the system of substance use and mental health. So it was $255 million they came up with out of the $1.2 billion. The governor, in his ultimate wisdom, cut it to $42 million. So that gives a big hole. Yeah. So it's my responsibility, along with Dr. Stortes, who's the president and CEO here, to tell the people why we need the $255 million and not just the $42 million. It's our responsibility to give them the most accurate information that we have here at the Leadership Council, because we're a trade organization and we represent 33 agencies here in the state of Rhode Island. We're the mouthpiece at the both the federal end of it and the state end of it to help our folks operate at a rate where we can give the most accurate information to our patients and the most transparent way of doing business. And I say that in a way because the state offices and the state departments sometimes are not always forthcoming in their information. And I've been saying this to the General Assembly, now being on the other side of the fence. When I was in the General Assembly, I thought every department in the state ran smooth. It ran so smooth, it was scary, until you come on this side. Now you look at the fence. There's a lot of holes underneath that damn fence.
Yeah.
A lot of holes. So I've been advocating now to start swearing in swearing in, put your right hand up, you swear to tell the truth, the whole, about the truth, to all the committees that these department heads have to go in front of. Because ultimately, because now that I'm on this side, I knew on the other side of the fence now, they were all lying to me. They only wanted me to hear what they had to say. It was good. It was great. Bah, 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 bah. And now I'm finding out the system is badly broken.
Is this a bureaucratic problem, or are there possibly, and I want to be careful how I phrase this, lobbyists advocating against some of the patient-centric policies? Where are these holes forming, and who is digging them?
I think, that's a very good point. It's a very good point. Because sometimes as a legislator, you rely very heavily on the lobbyists for information.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are telling you fibs, you don't know that until after the fact, until after you push that button, yeah, whether it's red or green. And then let me tell you something, it's happened to me. Have I had egg on my face? Absolutely. But I'm not like that on the other side of the fence. I will tell you not what you want to hear. I will tell you what's really happening on the street. And you make the decision. As I said to the committee last night, you have the authority right now to get this system back up and running at a financially pace that will keep everybody on board, everybody working, everybody operating, because if one of my outfits go out of business, you know what's going to happen to the emergency rooms? You're talking about 36 to 42 hour wait.
Wow.
Because everyone is maxed out. All 33 agencies that I represent are maxed out.
Do politicians understand the correlation between mental health services and hospital overutilization?
Most do now. They didn't in the beginning of the year, because when the Department of Health made that statement, a lot of eyebrows were raised about the wait time in the emergency room. And not only the wait time, it's about bringing your older mom or dad to the hospital and they tell you, oh, you can't go any further. They have to come in alone. Yeah, but they have dementia. I'm sorry, but we got to take them in. No visitors.
Wow.
Now, how do you talk to someone? And this happened to my boss. Her mom fell, whacked her head. She's got dementia. How do you ask that person what happened? They don't even know what they have for breakfast.
Yeah.
And no, I'm not making fun of anybody, but it's a reality. They don't even know what they have for breakfast. How do they know how they fell or what happened, or what medicines they're on? They don't know what medicines they're on. Yeah. It's just the whole system as a whole. I mean, thank God that the hospital merger didn't go through.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God. And we were all worried about that because it was going to be a hospital-based care system, which is very costly. All right. And a lot of my places would have went out of business, because the patients would have got sucked into the hospital system. But the community-based system is a hell of a lot cheaper than the hospital system.
Yeah.
A lot cheaper.
It's interesting when these relationships come to light and the financial association, almost as you had mentioned, the eyebrows are raised. And I think it takes a lot of advocating to get to that point. Let's look at where we are now, and let's look at where we could be at the end of this year, looking into 2023. What are some of the positives that we can achieve realistically this year? Are there state-based initiatives? Are there federal initiatives that can trickle down to the state that you see as clear-cut wins in advancing the conversation of addiction in America?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's a 8-month win. This is a long-term plan. We need to play as a long-term plan. I think the federal government, by them dumping a lot of money into mental health and substance use, was a great move.
Yeah,
I would have never thought that that amount of money would be brought into the system. But, you know, it's bad that we had COVID, but it's good that we had COVID because it raised a lot of eyebrows about mental health and substance use.
Yeah.
And the addiction. I mean, thank God we have Sheldon Whitehouse here, who is one of the key components to getting money into substance use and mental health. I think the CCBHCs, the community-based healthcare system, the federal government is seeing the amount of outcomes that are coming out of that. It's a huge win because a lot more people are not going to the hospital emergency rooms. They're going to the community-based healthcare system. That's why we were fighting last night for funding.
Yeah.
To get it up and running. And we have four now, or maybe five. And now they want to expand it to federal government. And it needs to be sustainable. It just can't be one and done. You know what I'm saying? The state has got to get behind it. But again, they don't look at it as a long-term plan. They look at it from July 1 to June 30th. You know, I mean, the outcomes that the current CCBHCs have, and the amount of money that they've saved over the past 3 years, as they're going into their fourth year now of federal funding, the outcomes have been unbelievable. But that being said, the state wants to do it their way and not the federal way. And that's a problem because you're not going to get the outcomes that the feds have by not mirroring what they're doing by you making your own rules and regulations to your own CCBHC, because now they have people that think they may have better answers than the feds have in Rhode Island. So now they want to tweak Rhode Island's, but not to match the feds. It's, and I have to be careful how I say it because we're working with them right now. It's not all about me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's not all about me. If you've got a federal program and it's working across the country, leave it alone.
Yeah.
Leave it alone. Rhode Island has a habit of starting programs, not funding it, and then figuring out and saying, what the hell happened? What happened? I mean, we got an epidemic. We have a pandemic, and now we're going to legalize marijuana on top of it. And we got an alcohol rate of 234%. It's like we're destroying Rhode Island.
Yeah.
We're destroying Rhode Island. I don't care about Massachusetts and Connecticut selling pot. Who cares? Who cares? It's not all about the money. You don't even know what the long-term effects are.
Yeah.
I know what the long-term effects are to alcohol because I see it all the time. I get calls all the time. I got a call yesterday from a building trades guy. You got to help me. My brother died 2 weeks ago of alcohol poisoning. I need to go in to get treatment.
Yeah.
Your heart breaks when you get those calls.
Yeah.
My phone is on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I get calls from everywhere. I got a call weeks ago from Las Vegas, a mother thanking me for putting her son into treatment. Those are the good calls.
Yeah.
Those are the good calls. That call will make you put your head on the pillow at night.
Yeah.
It's the calls that you don't get, and you see it in the Providence Journal. 25 years old, 30 years old, 45 years old, 414 of them last year.
Wow.
That's not even counting October, November, December. So we're at 430, I bet, 425.
It's amazing how these numbers continue to rise. What's interesting is that this discussion is trending away from politics and more into policy. You would imagine that's a good thing. But what you're finding is that now you have to deal with the bureaucracy, the machinations of politics, rife with its own problems. For those who may not understand and think that we're moving in the right direction because we seem to have political consensus, left and right, red and blue, that's not all. There's an additional layer of hurdles, and that's the policy world. Talk to people who may not understand how that itself is another barrier to effective patient care.
Well, I will tell you that Senator De Palma here in Rhode Island put a bill in to have rate review because we haven't had rate increases in 14 years. You know, Senator De Palma got 38 signatures on that bill. You know how many senators we have?
How many?
38. All 38 signed the document.
Wow. Congratulations.
You go on the House side, 6 out of 75. What gives here? Is it one people they don't understand? Or is it because the House starts the budget process over here, they're afraid to make a move? The moves need to be made. People have to pound their chests and bang on the desk like I do and say, folks, you got to spend it. You got to spend it. If you don't spend it now, forget it. It's over. The horse is already out of the barn. You got to spend it. We got to get adequate rates. We got to pay people the pay they deserve. You can't make more at McDonald's than you can do being a clinician. You can't have no nurses dosing on the weekend and have people not getting their doses for 3 or 4 days, because ultimately that's going to be a problem. Now we got methamphetamines moving into the state of Rhode Island. We have alcohol at 234%. This is worse. I believe, I mean, being boots on the ground, this is worse than a perfect storm. It's worse. You know, we got to get people to make more cemeteries if we're going to go down this road, because we're going to lose a lot more people. And when you get the calls here, when we get them here as sixth graders that got alcohol poisoning at 11 years old, what the hell? Yeah. What the hell? And now you got to bring marijuana into it. And the bill that they have on marijuana, I looked at it. I called the sponsor. I said, what are you doing? Advertising? You're going to have them put billboards up on the side of the road? I said, what doesn't you think a 12-year-old kid is going to see that billboard? He's going to want to try marijuana. I said, it's confusing now because they think the medical marijuana is good because it helps. It's a medical. They think it's good that kids smoke pot. I mean, this. Let me tell you something. Me and you can have a conversation all day long on this. All day long, week after week after week. And someone at the top is going to say, stop.
Yeah.
Take a breath. Let's try to fix the system. The system can no longer go down this field as it's going down. You know, we're on the 50-yard line now. And pretty soon we got to get to the goal line. But if we don't fix what's broken between the 50-yard line and the goal line, you're never going to get across the goal line. We're not going to save every child. We're not going to save every individual. People are going to astray from whatever we decide to do. But if we can save the bulk of the people, if we can get affordable housing, if we can get people access to care, the best thing that could have happened out of this pandemic was the virtual doctor's appointments. The best. Yeah. Because people feel comfortable in their own house, like me and you talking on the computer. They feel comfortable telling the doctor, doc, I don't know what's going on with me, blah, 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 blah. And the doctor can prescribe over the internet. That's the best thing that could have happened, because more people had access. You get the people in the inner cities that don't have bus rides. They don't have cars. They don't have access to go to the hospital. You know, so there's some good things that came out of it. I'm hoping that this year is session, whether it be here in Rhode Island or across the country, that mental health and substance use is on the forefront of everybody's agenda. It has to be. Mm-hmm. It has to be.
It's amazing how we all know what to do, but the process of doing what we know we have to do creates the problems themselves. It's very fascinating when you look at the policies turning into realities and just the process of it all. You have a show in which you are very vocal about these issues, in which you've essentially become a voice for many of the people in Rhode Island. I'd like to leave the audience with this. What do you hope to achieve with your show? And how can the listening audience hear more from you and what you believe in that show?
Well, Let me tell you what happened with the show. So I was on radio for 5 years, recovery radio. And the most I could attract was 22,000 listeners. Mm. And a TV station said, you know, maybe we should try TV. We can probably get more viewers and get more people to understand the issue and more resources for people to know where to go if they have a problem. I said, all right, let's try it. So I went to all my sponsors on the radio. I said, listen, instead of 200 a month, it's going to cost you 500 a month, but I can get you on 3 TV stations. Not one of them backed out.
Wow.
Not one of them backed out. And the prime sponsor, I had very harsh discussions with a few of the people because the first one at the table was in, and then number two and number three wanted the first spot. So I'm having infighting, you know, amongst the sponsorships to be the number one. So after we got that all squared away and we started with the show, the show started to go along. I filmed 4 to 5 shows in one day.
Wow.
So it's a daunting task to do those shows in one day, but it's cost effective. And we're on 3 different stations now. We're on MRI TV, CW TV, and Fox here in Rhode Island. And one on a Saturday night and 2 on Sunday morning. And I'm trying to get the 4th show now. I need a big sponsor to go on the local TV station. And we're trying to work on that sponsorship now. But my hope is that in a year, 2 years, they say, John, we don't need your show anymore. I'll be the happiest guy on the planet. I'm serious. I'll be the happiest guy on the planet. Will I lose money? Absolutely. But you know what? I save lives.
Yeah.
I save lives. And the bulk of my show is informational because the calls that we get here, people don't know what to do. They're frantic. You want to know another statistic I'm going to tell you right now? You know how many grandparents are watching their grandkids now because their sons or daughters are either incarcerated or dead in Rhode Island? 10,000 kids are being brought up by their grandparents right now.
Wow.
In Rhode Island, we're small. We're small. Yeah. I can just imagine in tough places like West Virginia, who the skyrocketed overdoses, Maine skyrocketed overdoses. I can just imagine what those parents, grandparents are doing with all those kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing to me that, you know, that statistic, when you tell people that statistic, they're like, you got to be kidding me. I said, no, it's a fact. It's a fact. 10,000 kids. Now, those kids, 10,000 kids are going to grow up with no mother and father. I mean, it's unfortunate that some kids have to grow up with no mother and father due to unsustainable incidences that they may have in their life, but not all these kids because of overdose or substance use or alcoholism. You know, it's a crazy thing. And again, I mean, my parents brought me up the right way. You know, if my mother and father were alive now, they'd be the happy as a clam seeing me on TV. They think it's the biggest thing since sliced bread. But let me tell you something. I hope to God that you have me on 2 years from now and say, John, what happened to your show? I said, I had to close it. We have no more overdoses.
Wow.
We have no more overdoses. I'd be the happiest guy on the planet.
Wow.
But you know what? I do it because I was brought up the right way. I want to make sure people have the right information and the location of services that they need, that they can just pick up the phone. Listen, everybody has my telephone number. It's on TV. Everybody has my telephone number. I don't care. If I can help you, I'll help you. If I can't help you, I'll tell you I can't help you.
Wow. And that being said, can you provide for the listening audience a way for them to get a hold of you via email or how they can reach you on your television show?
Thank you for having me. So it's Recovery TV, RI. You can put my name in, John Tassoni, T-A-S-S-O-N-I. It's on YouTube. And my phone number is 401-451-1305. And my email is John, J-O-H-N, at J-T, J as in John, T as in Tom, Sentinel, S-E-N-T-I-N-E-L, group group.com. And if I can help you, just pick up the phone or shoot me an email. I'll do whatever I can. You have my word.
Thank you so much, sir. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'll love to do it again at the end of session, which is in the beginning of July. And I'll tell you all the good things that I was able to accomplish. If not, I'll tell you all the bad things that happened.
Looking forward to it, sir.
All right. Thank you.